visions of my childhood arise before my gaze, bringing recollections of bygone happy days. When down in the meadow in childhood I would roam, no one's left to cheer me now within that good old home. Father and mother, they have passed away. Sister and brother now lay beneath the clay. But while life does remain to cheer me, I'll retain this small violet I'd plucked from mother's grave.
You are now entering London's East End to experience the Autumn of Terror. Please note that this episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent crimes, which may not be suitable for all audiences. The use of the term prostitution is in no way intended to cause offence, but it will be used in this series for historical accuracy, as that is what it was referred to back then. Primary sources have been used as much as possible. This series has been created with the utmost respect for the victims in mind.
Hello and welcome back to Prasher's Murder Map. This is the penultimate episode of the Jack the Ripper series, as we approach the horrendous climax of the Whitechapel murderer's rampage. We've explored the probably unrelated deaths of Emma Smith and Martha Tabram before hearing about each of the canonical victims: Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes. Now we'll uncover the abhorrent frenzied attack that marked the height of the Ripper's bloodlust and the final canonical victim, although many would argue that he didn't stop, continuing to kill in different ways. This murder is perhaps the most memorable, not because any of the victims are more or less important than any of the others, but because the death of Mary Jane Kelly was different in two ways. Firstly, because it happened indoors, and secondly, because it was the most grotesque and inhuman act of mutilation in the sequence. Don't forget to listen out for some very special guests appearing in this episode. Philip Hutchinson, well-known ripperologist, author and tour guide, will be playing surgeon Thomas Bond and witness George Hutchinson. Links to his ripper tour, his theatre company Lucky Dog Theatre Productions and books are in the show notes. I'm also joined by some fantastic podcasters. Charlie and Eileen, hosts of Crime Lab's podcast, are playing Mrs. Pomier and Lizzie Albrook respectively. Jenny, host of It's a Murder Up North podcast, is playing witness Sarah Lewis. Emily G. Thompson, author and host of Morbidology podcast, is playing Mary Jane Kelly. Eric Rivenus, author, historian and host of Most Notorious and Where Blood Runs Cold podcasts, has the distinction of being the only American involved in this production. He'll be playing a journalist reporting on the crime from across the pond. Don't forget, you'll also be hearing from Peter Blexley, author, broadcaster and former Scotland Yard detective, ripperologist Carl Kopak, and Adam, host of UK True Crime, in the final episode. Thank you so much to everyone taking part. Please listen out for them. So now it's time to jump in a hansom cab with me and we'll travel to Miller's Court, the scene of the slaughter that we're about to examine. Miller's Court was entered through a narrow brick archway, no more than 3 feet wide, off the north side of Dorset Street. This path extended about 20 feet into a courtyard, which housed a pokey, closed-in collection of poorly maintained cottages on both the left and right sides, with a wall and toilets at the end. This was a place where some of London's poorest lived, a place plagued not only by poverty, but also by crime. Even the police avoided going down there, unless they were in pairs. Around 1,500 men slept in lodging houses in Dorset Street each night, and a city missionary, distressed by the deprivation he saw, was astounded on one occasion to find 11 women sheltering overnight in the staircase of one house. There were several pubs nearby, including the Britannia, known as Ringers, the Horn of Plenty, and the Blue Coat Boy. Across the road on Commercial Street was Christchurch Spitalfields and its graveyard, christened Itchy Park by the locals because homeless people frequently slept there on the grass or against the gravestones during the day when the gates were opened, if they hadn't been able to find a bed overnight. Huddling in doorways wasn't an option, as the police would move them on. The word itchy referred to the lice that many of these people carried, as if their grinding poverty and life without a roof over their heads wasn't enough to contend with. Number 13 Miller's Court was a 10 by 12 foot room containing nothing more than a bed, two small tables, a fireplace and a washstand. The bed was behind the door, running the length of the partition wall, where it joined onto the back of 26 Dorset Street, which was used by the landlord to store goods. Upstairs were more tenants. The fireplace was on the opposite wall to the door, and there were two mismatched windows, one higher than the other, both set into the wall that looked out onto the court. One of these had two broken panes of glass, which had been stuffed with newspaper and rags to keep out the wind and rain. Just past number 13 was a small area with a water pump and refuse facilities. John McCarthy, landlord of number 13 and several other properties, ran a Chandler's shop in Dorset Street, just to the left of Miller's Court archway, selling candles, oils and groceries. At 10:45 a.m. on 9th of November 1888, McCarthy sent his employee, Thomas Boyer, to collect the 6 weeks' worth of rent money owed to him by Mary Kelly at number 13 Miller's Court, totalling 29 shillings. Boyer did as he was asked.
"Anyone home?"
He knew the window pane was broken, so he pulled out the paper and rags that were covering the hole, drew aside the sheet that was draped across the window, and peered into the room. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the darkness. What he saw would stay with him for the rest of his life. The first thing he spotted was a mound of flesh on the small table near the bed. The next thing he noticed was a blood streaked all over the walls. Then he saw a body lying on the bed. He ran back up to Dorset Street, trembling with horror, barely managing to gasp any words out to McCarthy. Both men returned to the window, and McCarthy looked in and saw for himself what had shaken Boyer so badly. The body on the bed was a mass of blood and flesh, chopped and slashed so much that it was unrecognisable. They ran to the Commercial Street police station, and Inspector Beck and Detective Constable Dew immediately went to Miller's Court. Now, just a quick side note, police constables were known as PCs and wore uniform, whereas detective constables were known as DCs and wore plain clothes as they were part of the CID, the Criminal Investigations Department. Inspector Beck squinted through the window into the dimly lit room.
"For God's sake, DC Drew, don't look!"
Dew needed no further warning. Later, McCarthy described what he had seen.
"It looked like the work of the devil, more than a man. I'd heard a great deal about the Whitechapel murders, but I declare to God I'd never expected to see such a sight as this. The whole scene is more than I can describe. I hope I may never see such a sight as this again."
Police closed off the court to everyone, including the array of journalists hovering like a plague of locusts and waited for instructions from their seniors. There was a rumour that the bloodhounds Barnaby and Burgo, who met Police Commissioner Sir Charles Warren, had recently trialled, might be on their way, so the crime scene remained untouched. What they didn't realise is that Sir Charles Warren had resigned his post the previous day, and the bloodhounds weren't coming. Eventually, at around 1:30 p.m, nearly 3 hours after the body was discovered, they decided they could wait no longer. On the orders of Superintendent Arnold, landlord John McCarthy prized open the door with a pickaxe. In pitiful contrast with the blood-soaked tableau before them, Mary Jane Kelly's clothes lay neatly folded on a chair, her boots arranged in front of the fireplace, as if she would be coming back to put them on at any moment. A roaring fire had been burning in the grate, so hot that it had melted the spout of the kettle. Several items of clothing had been burnt, later found to belong to one of Mary Kelly's friends, Maria Harvey, who sometimes stayed with her. She'd left behind a curious array of garments: an overcoat, two dirty cotton shirts, a boy's shirt, a girl's white petticoat, and a black crepe bonnet. Police deduced that the killer had burned some of these items to keep the fire going, to light up the room while he carried out his depraved defilement. After the body was transported to the Shoreditch mortuary, it took 6 hours to piece the remains together and inspect the injuries in detail. Mary's boyfriend, Joseph Barnett, identified her from her ears and her eyes, as all the other facial features were completely destroyed. Police surgeon Dr. Thomas Bond's report was a lengthy one. Here's some extracts.
The body was lying in the middle of the bed. The legs were wide apart. The whole of the surface of the abdomen and thighs was removed, and the abdominal cavity emptied of its viscera. The breasts were cut off, the arms mutilated by several jagged wounds, and the face hacked beyond recognition. The tissues of the neck were severed all round down to the bone. The viscera were found in various parts: the uterus, kidneys, and one breast under the head, the other breast by the right foot, the liver between the feet, the intestines by the right side, and the spleen by the left side. The flaps removed from the abdomen and thighs were on a table. The bedclothing was saturated with blood, and on the floor beneath was a pool of blood covering about 2 feet square. The wall by the right side of the bed and in a line with the neck was marked by blood, which had struck it in a number of separate splashes. The face was gashed in all directions, the nose, cheeks, eyebrows, and ears partly removed. The lips were cut by several incisions running obliquely down to the chin. There were numerous cuts extending irregularly across all the features. The neck was cut through the skin and other tissues right down to the vertebra. Both breasts were removed by circular incisions. The intercostals between the 4th, 5th, and 6th ribs were cut through, and the contents of the thorax visible through the openings. The skin and tissues of the abdomen were removed in 3 large flaps. The left calf showed a long gash through skin and tissues to the deep muscles, reaching from the knee to 5 inches above the ankle. Both arms had extensive jagged wounds. On opening the thorax, it was found that the lower part of the right lung was broken and torn away. The heart was absent.
It was clear they were dealing with a killer, the likes of which they'd never encountered before. The mutilations to the first victims had been harrowing enough, but now, in the shelter of a private room, with no need to rush or the fear of being stumbled upon in the street by a passerby, the Ripper had fulfilled his urge to completely and utterly butcher a body. Some people argue that this shows a clear escalation from the murder of Polly Nichols onwards, as a disfigurement of each corpse worsened each time, with the exception of Liz Stride, who, as we discussed in episode 4, may not even have been a Ripper victim. But others believe this was what he'd craved all along, and would have done so if he'd had the opportunity. This was simply the first time he'd been able to attack his victim indoors, with less chance of being caught. There's a myth that Mary Kelly's entrails were hung from picture hooks in the room, but there's no evidence of this, although it's easy to see why some people think it, as they misinterpret the shadows and marks in the poor quality photos, possibly cast by a shaft of light. By the way, please don't go looking for the photo of Kelly's body unless you have a very strong stomach. It might be blurry and in black and white, but it's not something you'll forget easily. I can only imagine the effect it must have had on McCarthy, Boyer, Inspector Beck, and everyone who saw the crime scene in reality. Now let's look at Mary Jane Kelly's life and what happened in the days before her death. Although they may not have realised it, this was the final chance for detectives to find any clues to catch the faceless killer who'd been stalking the East End for months. Was there anything that could have shed light on the mystery? Mary Jane Kelly, although we don't know for sure if that was her real name, was probably born in 1863, so she was 25 at the time of her death. We know little about her life except for what she told her friends, and sadly, we don't even know exactly what she looked like due to the extent of the mutilations. She said she was born in Limerick, Southern Ireland, with six or seven brothers and one sister. One brother, Jonto, was serving in the 2nd Battalion Scots Guards. The family moved to Wales when she was a young child, and her father, John Kelly, worked as a foreman at the ironworks. We don't know whether she would have had an Irish accent or a Welsh one, or maybe a hybrid of both. She married a collier, another name for a miner, when she was just 16, but he tragically died in a pit explosion 2 or 3 years later. She told people that she then moved to Cardiff and stayed in an infirmary for 9 months, although it's not clear what illness she was suffering from. In 1884, she moved to London and began working as a prostitute at a West End brothel. She visited France at least once with a wealthy gentleman, but didn't enjoy it and returned to London, at which point she found herself in the East End. The stories of the various places she lived in haven't all been verified, but we do know that at one point she lived with a plasterer named Joseph Fleming near Bethnal Green Road, probably around 1886. After breaking up with Fleming, she stayed in Cooney's lodging house, not the one in Flower and Dean Street, where you might remember Catherine Eddowes often lodged, but the one in Thrall Street. While lodging there, she met Joseph Barnett in April 1887, a porter at Billingsgate Fish Market. They had a painfully low income and were regularly behind on their rent, moving from place to place when they couldn't pay their bills. In the spring of 1888, they moved to 13 Miller's Court. Mary Kelly was 5'7", taller than many women of the time. She had blonde hair, blue eyes and pale skin. Although she was known for her stormy temper when drunk, she was quiet and friendly when sober. She apparently spoke fluent Welsh, and a friend described her as much superior to that of most persons in her position in life. Another acquaintance said she was not a notorious character and was well liked by everyone she met. One of Mary's previous landladies described her as coming from a well-to-do family and said she was an excellent scholar and an artist. She once told someone she had a relative who acted on the stage. When she first arrived in London, it's thought that she might have stayed with nuns at a refuge on Crispin Street, scrubbing floors and cleaning for them, and then went into domestic service in a shop. It's not clear how she ended up turning to prostitution on the Whitechapel streets, when she'd previously had a more comfortable place at the high-end brothel, but without any family or a support network in the area, she must have found herself in a difficult situation. Joe Barnett would later state that her brother had visited once and her father had tried to find her, but Mary had hidden from him. A city missionary said she had shown him letters from her mum in Limerick, so perhaps she was still on good terms with her, but as far as anyone knows, she had little contact with any of her family. Friend Lizzie Albrook told the inquest about the last conversation she'd had with Kelly.
About the last thing she said to me was, "Whatever you do, don't you do wrong and turn out as I did." She'd often spoken to me in this way, and warned me against going on the street as she had done. She told me, too, that she was heartily sick of the life she was leading, and wished she had money enough to go back to Ireland where her people lived. I do not believe she would have gone out as she did, if she had not been obliged to do so, to keep herself from starvation.
Giving advice to Lizzie wasn't the only occasion that Mary Kelly showed her kindness. Her boyfriend Joseph Barnett stated that he'd left her on October the 30th, 1888, less than 2 weeks before she was killed, because he wasn't happy about her allowing prostitutes to stay in their room.
She would never have gone wrong again. I shouldn't have left her if it hadn't been for the prostitute stopping at the house. She only let them stay because she was good-hearted and did not like to refuse them shelter on cold, bitter nights. We lived comfortably until Mary allowed a prostitute named Julia to sleep in the same room. Then another named Maria Harvey, and I objected and took lodgings elsewhere. It was during an alcohol-fueled argument about this that either Mary or Joe had thrown something and broken the window of 13 Miller's Court. Barnett and Kelly were remembered as a friendly and pleasant couple, who didn't cause any trouble unless they were drunk. But this was one of the occasions when their tempers got the better of them.
Read to me from the paper, Joe. Is there anything about the Ripper in there?
Oh, nothing new. They haven't caught him. It looks like that stuff about Leather Apron was a load of old bobbins.
I don't like to think about it. It's horrible. It could be any one of us next.
Well, you'd be alright if you didn't keep the sort of company you do. That Mrs. Harvey not coming back here tonight, is she?
I told her she could, Joe. She hasn't got anywhere to sleep otherwise. Come on, don't spoil it. Read the paper to me.
I won't stand for it, Mary. I've put up with it long enough. It's either them or me. You can let your prostitute friends sleep on the floor if you like, but I won't stay here if they do. They're women of evil life.
If that's how you feel about it, go on and leave.
The broken window came in useful, however, when the key to the room was lost and Kelly and Barnett developed a system of reaching through the hole from the outside to access the door handle. This raises some questions if this were true, such as why did McCarthy need to use a pickaxe to prise the door open, rather than just reaching through the window himself? Despite moving out, Joe Barnett continued to visit Mary on an almost daily basis, giving her money when he could afford to, although he'd lost his fish porter's license a few months before, so he no longer had a regular job at the market. Fish porters needed a license to work, and they were the only ones allowed to transport fish. They wore numbered badges on their aprons to identify them and spent their days carrying heavy boxes of fresh fish around, a physically demanding and no doubt smelly job. There were fish porters at Billingsgate right up until 2012, and those who worked there were proud of their camaraderie and the shared heritage of their profession, right up until the City Corporation of London stripped away their licences to hire a cheaper workforce. Mary Jane Kelly seemed to be on good terms with her ex-partner Joseph Fleming too, who also visited Miller's Court from time to time. When she was last seen, she was wearing a dress made of a plain, cheap fabric called linsey, with a red shawl pulled across her shoulders and no hat. She was known to always wear a spotlessly clean white apron and often went around with two or three friends. On Thursday, 8th of November, Joe Barnett visited Mary at Miller's Court at around 7 p.m. When he arrived, her friend Lizzie Albrook was there, and Maria Harvey had also been there earlier, but had left shortly before 7. Lizzie left around 8 p.m, and Joe went back to his lodging house. He told Mary he was sorry, but he didn't have any money to give her that day, and they parted on good terms. At 11:45 p.m, Mary Ann Cox, a widow living in Miller's Court, had been out looking for clients, but as it was cold and wet, she decided to go home to warm up for a while. She noticed Mary Kelly and a man of large build walking ahead of her. She described the man as in his mid-30s, 5'5", shabbily dressed in dark clothes, a long dark overcoat, with a billycock hat, another name for a bowler hat, a blotchy face, small side whiskers, and a carroty moustache. He was carrying a pot of beer. Both he and Mary appeared to be drunk. Cox followed them down the passage into the court and past Kelly as she was about to go inside number 13, although intriguingly, she made no mention of seeing her putting her hand into the window to reach the handle and open the door. So perhaps she'd left it unlocked or on the latch. After all, she had nothing of value to steal.
Hello, Mary Ann. I'm going to sing for this man I've brought home.
A few minutes later, Cox heard her singing the song, "Only a Violet I Plucked from Mother's Grave."
Days,
Cox went out again around midnight and heard Mary Kelly still singing the same song. Around this time, she must also have had a meal of fish and potatoes, which the coroner found partially digested in her stomach during the post-mortem. This could have been bought at McCarthy's store around the corner, as Chandler's shops often sold takeaway food like fish and chips. Although if Kelly owed him 29 shillings, she probably wouldn't have shown her face in there, unless someone went in and bought it for her. It's also worth noting that lack of sleep can slow down the digestive process, which could confuse the calculation for time of death. It wasn't long before singing began to annoy the neighbours. The rooms were crammed in so close together that they would all have been able to hear everything going on in the neighbouring cottages, which makes what happened later, with apparently no noise whatsoever, all the more unsettling. Flower seller Catherine Pickett was going to knock on Kelly's door to complain, but her husband told her not to, saying, "You leave the poor woman alone." Despite disliking her singing, Pickett would later tell the inquest that Mary was a good, quiet, pleasant girl and well liked by all of us. At 1 a.m. Mary Ann Cox returned once again to Miller's Court to warm up for a while. Mary Kelly was still singing and a light was coming from behind her window. After a few minutes in her room, Cox left again, still in need of a client to earn some money. Directly above Mary Kelly's room lived Elizabeth Prater, who also earned money through sex work after her husband left her 5 years before. There were only floorboards keeping her room and Mary's apart, so every sound from downstairs could be heard by Elizabeth. Between 1 and 1:30 a.m, Prater was standing at the entrance to Miller's Court waiting for a client before returning to her room. She heard nothing from Mary's room below. At 1:30 a.m, Prater placed two chairs against the door to keep out intruders and went to bed. Here's where the story becomes rather colourful, in an intriguing turn of events which has led to much debate over the years. At 2 a.m, a witness named George Hutchinson, who might have been a groom or stable hand, was making his way down Commercial Street after walking back from Romford, about 11 miles east. He lodged at the Victoria Working Men's Home, but its doors were already closed for the night. You see, if you had the money, some lodging houses allowed you to buy a weekly pass, which would grant entry to your room at any time of day or night. But if you made do with paying for your bed each evening, the doors would shut at a certain time, and no amount of knocking would get you inside. Hutchinson said that as he passed Flower and Dean Street, he saw Mary Jane Kelly, who he knew.
"George, will you lend me a sixpence?"
"Sorry, Mary, I spent all my money down Romford today."
"Good morning, then. I must go find some money."
She then continued walking in the direction from which Hutchinson had just come, and a man appeared and approached her. He put his hand on her shoulder, and she laughed, and Hutchinson heard parts of a muttered conversation.
"All right."
"You will be all right for what I have told you?"
Hutchinson then watched as the pair walked back towards Dorset Street. By this time, Hutchinson was standing under a lamppost near the Queen's Head pub, and he watched the man intently, more intently than would have been normal, if his vividly detailed description was anything to go by.
"He was aged about 34 or 35 and was 5'6" tall. His complexion was pale with dark eyes and eyelashes, a slight moustache curled up at each end, and dark hair. He was very surly looking and returned my gaze with a stern glare. He was wearing a long dark coat and the collar and cuffs were trimmed with astrakhan and a dark jacket underneath. A light waistcoat, dark trousers, a dark felt hat turned down in the middle, button boots and gaiters with white buttons. He wore a very thick gold chain. He had a white linen collar and a black tie with a horseshoe pin. He was a respectable appearance, but shabby genteel, I should say. He walked very sharp and was of Jewish appearance. I could identify him again if I saw him."
Unfortunately, Hutchinson only came forward with this description after the inquest was over, and his story was subsequently embellished with extra details, including bushy eyebrows, a large seal on the gold chain with a red stone hanging from it, and that he was carrying kid gloves in his right hand and a small package in his left. His assertion that he could identify the man if he saw him again turned out to be a little too hopeful, as detectives escorted him around the area for 2 days in the hope he could point him out and paid him handsomely for his time. But the shabby genteel man had apparently vanished into thin air. Hutchinson alleged that he saw Mary Kelly and this character, who is known in ripperologist circles as Astrakhan Man, turning towards Miller's Court. At the entrance to the court, Kelly said,
"All right, my dear, come along. You will be comfortable."
She then kissed him before saying she'd lost her handkerchief. The man gave her a red one, and they made their way towards her room at number 13. Hutchinson, according to the story told police, remained under the lamppost opposite the archway, near Crossingham's lodging house, for about an hour. When the bells of Christchurch marked 3 a.m, he decided to leave and find somewhere to sleep. What he was doing there is the subject of much contention, but many believe that as he knew Mary, he was hoping she would let him stay for the night once her client had left, but eventually got bored waiting. Hutchinson's story about Astrakhan Man seems unlikely for a few reasons. First of all, the lighting in the area was poor, and even though he was standing under a street lamp, it would have been difficult for him to pick out so many details of the man's clothing, especially when he didn't see him for that long. Also, why would he have bothered to remember the man's appearance? At the time, he had no idea he could have been looking at Jack the Ripper, and would have seen him as just another of Kelly's clients. Even if he had an excellent memory and powers of observation, a man of such distinctive appearance would have been noticed by others. Someone dressed so well with gaiters, kid gloves, a gold chain, and Astrakhan trimmings would stick out like a sore thumb in the worst part of the East End, at the very least finding himself the object of unwanted attention and probably having his pockets emptied by thieves, or worse. There is a witness who saw a man standing where Hutchinson claimed to be. Sarah Lewis spoke at the inquest.
"Between 2 and 3 o'clock this morning, I came to stop with the Keelers at number 2, Miller's Court, as I'd had a few words with my husband. When I came to the court, there was a man standing over against the lodging house on the opposite side in Dorset Street. He was not tall, but stout, and was wearing a black wide-awake hat. Shortly before 4 o'clock, I heard a scream, like that of a young woman, and seemed not to be far away. She screamed out, 'Murder!' I only heard it once. I did not look out the window. I did not know the deceased."
A wide-awake hat is a broad-brimmed, Quaker-style hat. It's likely that the man she saw was Hutchinson, although some have suggested that Hutchinson himself could have been the Ripper, and he only came forward after the inquest because he read about it in the paper and realised he'd been seen. It wasn't unheard of for specific details to be strategically held back, so he could have been worried that someone had seen him very closely or recognised him, so he decided to come forward with his tale about the Astrakhan Man to turn attention away from himself. Or he could have been partially telling the truth and was simply waiting to see if Kelly would give him shelter for the night, but didn't want to admit it, in case this made him sound even more suspicious. He claimed to have known her for 3 years, and that he'd given her a few shillings whenever he could, which seems a lot of money for a casual acquaintance to give, when he didn't have much himself. His biography is as patchy as Mary Kelly's, and nobody really knows what became of him later. Anyway, the description of Astrakhan Man just doesn't sound plausible and seems to have been plucked straight from the newspapers and cartoons printed in recent weeks, pointing the finger at a Jew. Neither the blotchy-faced man with the carroty moustache nor the Astrakhan Man matched any of the other descriptions of men seen with the victims just before the murders. It's possible Hutchinson created this description by combining bits from the previous witness reports. For example, the red handkerchief he mentioned sounds similar to the red neckerchief seen by Joseph Lavender in the Eddowes murder, and the parcel he said Astrakhan Man was carrying is reminiscent of the policeman who saw someone carrying a package near the scene of the Stride murder. In the next and final episode of the series, I'll be talking about the suspects in more detail, as well as why I don't believe the killer was a Jew, despite what the propaganda of the time would have us believe. Not long after Hutchinson departed, Marianne Cox returned to her room again and this time stayed there for the rest of the night. By now, there was no sound or light coming from number 13. She couldn't sleep and heard men going in and out of the court several times and someone leaving one of the rooms at 5:45 a.m. but didn't hear a door shut afterwards and wasn't sure exactly where the noise came from. At 4 a.m, Elizabeth Prater, asleep in the room above Mary Kelly's, was startled awake by her kitten Diddles, and shortly afterwards heard a faint cry of, "Oh, murder!" Probably the same cry that Sarah Lewis heard. This could therefore be the time of Kelly's death. This kind of shout was a common occurrence, so it's not necessarily connected. Also, given how thin the partitions were between the walls, you'd have thought Elizabeth would have been able to tell if it came from directly below. At 7:30 a.m, flower seller Catherine Pickett, who had been kept awake by the singing, wanted to borrow a shawl from Kelly. She knocked on her door several times, but got no answer. More confusion has been added to an already muddy set of circumstances by two people who thought they saw Mary alive later that morning. Caroline Maxwell, wife of a lodging house keeper, claimed she saw her at 8:30 a.m, on the 9th of November, and then again at 9 a.m, outside the Britannia, and that Mary was suffering the effects of too much alcohol and vomited. But Caroline didn't know the victim that well, and her testimony wasn't taken seriously. Taylor Morris Lewis was gambling with friends in Miller's Court at around 10 a.m, playing a game called Pitch and Toss. A lookout boy shouted a warning, so they left and went into the Britannia pub. He thought he'd seen Mary inside, but less than an hour later he heard the news that she'd been found dead in her room. It wouldn't have made sense for her to be out at 9:30 in the morning, then go home, get undressed, and fold up her clothes neatly as if to go to bed. Also, nobody else at the pub came forward to say Mary had been there that morning, and if the murder had been committed at 10 a.m. or so, somebody would surely have seen the killer leaving Kelly's room. As for Maxwell's story about her vomiting, that wouldn't add up with the fact that fish and potatoes were found in her stomach, unless she'd eaten them afterwards, but that wouldn't have allowed much time for the killer to do his work and escape before Thomas Boyer came to collect the rent. These inexplicable sightings and the fact that the body was desecrated so badly that the face was unrecognisable have led to conspiracy theories that the victim wasn't Mary Kelly after all, and was someone else, perhaps friend Maria Harvey, an idea given credence by the fact that remnants of Maria's clothes were found on the fire. Most people think it's more likely Maxwell and Lewis just got their days muddled up and had really seen Kelly the day before. Her remains were identified, not just by Barnett, but also by George Hutchinson and landlord John McCarthy. Mrs. Pomier, a nearby roasted chestnut seller, also had a curious set of events to relate.
I was approached at about midday on the 9th of November by a well-dressed man. He said, "I suppose you've heard about the murder in Dorset Street." I said that no, I hadn't. He grinned at me and said, "I know more about it than you." He stared me in the face, then walked down Sandys Row, looking back over his shoulder at me as he went. He was about 5'6", with a black moustache, wearing a black silk hat, a black coat and speckled trousers. He also carried a black shiny bag, about a foot in depth and about a foot and a half in length. He'd been going around accosting young women these last few nights, and when they asked him what he had in the bag, he replied, "Something the ladies don't like."
This was corroborated by Sarah Lewis, the witness who'd probably seen George Hutchinson standing opposite Miller's Court on the night of the murder. She said that a week before in Bethnal Green, she and a female friend had been approached by a suspicious man carrying a black bag. Joe Barnett was questioned but had an alibi. He was at his lodging house, Buller's, in New Street, playing whist until 12:30 and then went to bed. When he heard about the murder, he voluntarily went to the police, and they were satisfied with his statements. He became unwelcome at Buller's when the attention from journalists grew overwhelming, so they asked him to leave and he went to stay with his sister. The witness testimonies got police nowhere. They knew no more about the killer with any more certainty than they had when the first canonical killing took place at the end of August in Bucks Row. The one thing they did know was that they were dealing with a dangerous, vicious spectre who appeared like a ghost seemingly from nowhere to commit his evil and barbarous acts before disappearing once again. He had breathtaking audacity and an astonishing streak of luck. How was it possible that he could slaughter Mary Jane Kelly in her room, surrounded by other cottagers with paper-thin walls, yet nobody heard a thing? There was only one way in and out of the court, so he must have had nerves of steel as he walked away and made his escape after the bloodbath, knowing he risked passing other residents as he left. As he did so, he would have been holding his victim's still warm heart, as this was missing from the scene. Hearts don't burn easily, and there was no trace of it in the fireplace, so the murderer must have taken it as a macabre trophy. News of the murder even reached the other side of the Atlantic. Here's an article printed in the New York Herald on November the 11th.
36 hours have passed since the ghastly discovery in Miller's Court, Dorset Street. And nothing more has become known about the murder or murderer than what was sent to the Herald last night. Neighbors have been fancifully garrulous. Absurdly ineffectual arrests have been made, and sensational journals have printed a number of absurd, groundless rumors. It is still said the police are reticent. Quite so, and for the best of all reasons, they know nothing. Sir Charles Warren has issued a proclamation offering a pardon to any accomplice. As if so secretive a murderer possessed accomplices. A story is afloat that the victim was seen outside in the morning, shortly before the shocking discovery. But medical evidence shows that this was impossible, as from post-mortem signs, she had been dead some hours. New York Herald, November 11th, 1888.
Mary Jane Kelly was buried at St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Cemetery in Leytonstone on 19th of November. Henry Wilton, sexton of a local church, paid for the funeral himself and set up a fund for people to contribute, but never received enough to reimburse him for the costs in an area so ravaged by poverty. The news of the murder was published internationally, so her family may have found out about her tragic death, but they didn't attend the funeral. It's possible that Mary Jane Kelly wasn't her real name, and if so, they might not have realised it was her. Mary was a common name at the time, as was Kelly, as an Irish surname. Crowds of people lined the streets to watch Mary Jane take her final journey in the hearse. For many years, nobody was sure where her grave was, and someone even erected a memorial at the wrong plot in 1986. A few years later, a new memorial was put up at the correct spot. Dorset Street was renamed Duval Street in 1904 and became the site of more murders. In 1901, Mary Ann Austin was stabbed to death at number 35, where Annie Chapman had once lodged. And 5 years later, Katie Roman had her throat cut at number 12 Miller's Court. In the 1960s, a man was shot in the building opposite, almost exactly where George Hutchinson had stood. Even today, people still leave plastic flowers, rosaries, ornaments, and even bottles of gin at Mary Kelly's grave, a symbol of the lasting effect that the brutal manner of her death has had on anyone who learns her story. Will we ever know the truth and be able to bring justice to the victims of the ruthless string of inhuman murders in the East End? Join me again next time for the final instalment of this series, where I'll tackle the major suspects, debunk some myths, and talk about incarnations of Jack the Ripper in film throughout the decades. Until next time, take care, everyone.